Well, there's no denying that we have some great content today, but you know where else there is some great content? It's over at Brian and my other project, the Intensive Care Academy, where you will find, oh gosh, nearly 40 hours right now of video lessons online that you can watch at your own pace, getting into all kinds of critical care topics from the very general to the very specialized, and we think you will love it. You also get access to a couple of private podcast feeds with even more material, some live hangouts with us, and a whole bunch more. Check it out if you have not, ICU101.com. Otherwise, let's get to the show.
Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. It is Brandon back here with Brian.
Hello, everyone.
And we're going to tackle some neuro stuff, Brian's neck of the woods these days. But we're always excited to have guests on who can provide a specialty perspective, which is, you know, tightly linked with what we do in critical care, but is also not the specific things we do. And of course, we do a lot of that, supportive things, especially in the surgical world and neurosurgical world. And that's kind of where we're getting to today. The topic is thrombectomy, which is kind of a hot area in the sense that I remember when I was in school, I think I wrote a paper reviewing the literature on thrombectomy for ischemic stroke. And at the time, there was not much compelling data yet that it was the right thing to do. And things have clearly evolved since. I would say it's becoming the standard of care for strokes when patients are eligible, or at least perhaps the thing that you'd like to have. You might still show up at a center with your stroke that they couldn't do it, but you'd probably wish that you were elsewhere. So we do a lot of supportive things for those patients, but of course the procedures are generally done by somebody else. Somebody like our guest today, Justin Fraser, who is a professor and also the vice chair of neurological surgery down at University of Kentucky, where Brian is, where he's also the director of cerebrovascular surgery and neurointerventional radiology. And he specializes in endovascular interventions, skull-based surgery, and some other things. But most importantly, he does thrombectomies, and he's going to try to shed some light on this for those of us who are not interventionalists. Welcome, Dr. Fraser.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. I'm going to give you a little case we'll start with, and we'll just kind of go along with that. So you're doing your normal thing. You're on call or doing your regular stuff at UK. You're in the, you know, doing surgeries or whatever. And you get a call from the stroke attending, the stroke neurology attending. I'll try not to use too much UK inside lingo since Dr. Fraser and I work together. You get the stroke neurology attending calls you and says, I've just accepted this patient for transfer from an outside hospital who's had a stroke, and I think she might be a good thrombectomy candidate. Basically, this is a 64-year-old lady. She was at home talking to her daughter on the phone and suddenly stopped talking. The daughter got very nervous, hung up, called 911, went over, found her mom responsive but unable to speak, and plegic on the right. EMS arrived a few minutes later, took her to the outside hospital. She got a CT scan at the outside that showed no hemorrhage. And so they gave her TNK and called UK to transfer her. And so now she's been accepted for transfer and she's in the air right now flying up. What are your first thoughts when you hear this?
Well, based on your description, I would be concerned about what we call an emergent large vessel occlusion or LVO. This is basically an occlusion of a major blood vessel of the circumvallus. In this patient's case, I'd be very suspicious for an occlusion either at the left internal carotid artery or the middle cerebral artery M1 segment, based on your description. And so we would be preparing for possible thrombectomy. There are, you know, in terms of, and I don't mean to modify your case, but there have been a number of technological developments in the last few years that make it extremely unlikely these days that we get the phone call with no imaging. So, and we can talk about that if you like. I mean, there's been such an amazing drive towards the new technology that now it's atypical for us to get a phone call from an outside hospital about one of these cases because most of our collaborating institutions have a remote imaging provider where basically I would see the films before they're even activated and we're even being called, which has been a huge boon to rapid transit of these patients. But yeah, we'd be very concerned about a large vessel occlusion. Most outside hospitals now have vascular imaging, so oftentimes we'll know before they are even in the air where the blockage is, which is really nice because often in such cases, when they arrive at UK, we skip imaging altogether and we go straight to the angio suite. So that saves a lot of time, and time is brain. So, you know, as our audience knows, every minute that ticks by, you're losing millions of neurons. And so, you know, every minute counts, whether it be minutes spent, you know, in the ambulance versus the helicopter, whether it's minutes spent trying to interpret imaging, making decisions, getting other providers on the phone to accept the transfer. Each of these steps can, you know, if we can get them down to just a few minutes, that's a huge win for patient outcomes.
Yeah. So typically then we're talking about imaging at the outside being a non-contrast CT of the head and a CTA of the head and neck.
CTA. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Some outside hospitals will do CT perfusion scans, but increasingly we're not using those in our decision making because of some recent trials that came out really showing us that we should be doing this procedure. Brandon, you mentioned that this may be the standard of care, and I apologize. I'm not trying to be controversial here or contrary, but I would argue, and many would, that for large vessel occlusions, thrombectomy is the standard of care now. There's no question about it.
And what that means is, of course, not everyone can do it, but if you cannot, you should consider transferring a patient somewhere that can.
I would say, and again, not to be contrary, I wouldn't even say use the word consider. I would use the word you must. If keeping a large vessel occlusion patient that would otherwise be a candidate for thrombectomy in a hospital that is incapable of performing thrombectomy, not transferring them would be a major, major deviation from our current state of practice.
I mean, in a lot of ways, isn't this very similar to the debate around coronary angiography, PTCI from 20 years ago?
Right. In some respects, I'm glad you brought that up because in some respects, PCI, coronary intervention carries, I may be misquoting a little bit. So if there are cardiologists in the audience, I apologize. But I believe the number needed to treat for those patients is somewhere in the order of like 8 to 11, somewhere in that range. The estimated number needed to treat for thrombectomy is about 2. Which makes it one of the most powerful and effective urgent treatments in all of medicine.
Why do you think it is that we've seen, I think it's been settled science, right, for, like I said, decades, that cardiac patients should go to the cath lab, right? We don't even debate should we give them TPA or go to the cath lab anymore. They just go to the cath lab. Why is that not already been the standard of care for stroke patients?
Well, yes. So just to kind of give you a little history lesson on that. So you mentioned TNK. Intravenous thrombolytics, initially IV TPA and more recently TNK. So the data, the big clinical trials for intravenous thrombolytics for stroke were in the mid 90s and early 2000s, really establishing that as the benchmark treatment for emergent treatment of stroke, right? And thrombectomy started to come on the scene in the early 2000s. In fact, one of the people that trained me how to do neurointervention was one of the co-inventors of the first thrombectomy device. And in many respects, it was practiced in a very niche environment in academic medical centers without a whole lot of big data. And then kind of late 2000s, early 2010s, clinical trials started to roll out looking at thrombectomy. And at the same time, companies that make endovascular devices were starting to build better tools to allow us to do this safely. So there along came a trial called the IMS-3 trial, which was supposedly a head-to-head trial between medical management, including thrombolytics, against all of that plus thrombectomy. And the trial failed. And so when that trial came out, failed meaning that those who got thrombectomy did not appear to do better. So when that trial came out, we were all, everyone was aghast. And, you know, there was a lot of catastrophizing on the part of neurointerventionalists, basically saying, oh my goodness, thrombectomy doesn't work, yada, yada. But then we started to look at the trial in depth and realize that, you know, and I don't say this to disparage my colleagues that were, you know, major contributors to that trial design, but the trial itself, had some, I don't want to use the word, I hate to use the word flaws. I mean, it was designed well, but the way in which they were asking the questions did not create an environment for us to truly ask and answer the question about large vessel occlusion. Some patients were not allowed, you know, didn't require certain imaging. Some patients were taken to angio. There were all sorts of critiques to the trial. I could give a whole hour-long lecture about that. But to fast forward, I'll simply say that everyone was left with this question of, is this really the truth? And so you had a number of different clinical trials that were head-to-head thrombectomy trials for large vessel occlusion that started as a result of that. And it's the only time I've ever seen this happen in medicine where you had multiple clinical trials with some little variations, essentially asking the same question. Does thrombectomy help patients with large vessel occlusion? And the Mr. Clean, as it was called, that's a moniker for one of the trials, came out first saying it definitely helps. And several of the other trials had to stop early because their ethics boards basically said, hey, it's no longer ethical to enroll patients in the control group because thrombectomy is so effective. And so they released their results showing that thrombectomy was extremely effective. And at the time, we were limiting ourselves to just within 6 hours of last known normal time. Last known normal time being the time that the patient was last seen neurologically normal. But of course, that could be extremely limiting, especially for patients coming from far distances, patients out in rural communities that had a hard time getting recognized and brought in, patients who were wake-up strokes who were last seen the night before. So then you start to get into additional clinical trials coming out looking at prolonged intervals, and those trials were positive. And so suddenly we're doing a lot of thrombectomies. And then most recently you had situations where patients would come in with a large vessel occlusion, but they'd have a big completed stroke on non-contrast head CT. And, you know, everyone said, oh, those patients won't benefit because their stroke is already complete. And somebody said, are you sure about that? And so let's do a clinical trial. In fact, two were done to look at that very issue. And lo and behold, those patients still benefited. So all of a sudden, for large vessel occlusion, almost always we take the patients for thrombectomy now.
And you mentioned, so we're getting away from even doing the CT perfusion scans because there's still benefit, even if they have so-called completed strokes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely true. Initially, the CT perfusion scans were used to rule out patients for thrombectomy with the idea that the thrombectomy was, or the stroke was complete. But the reality is that once we demonstrated that those patients with quote-unquote complete strokes on CT actually still benefited, the CT perfusion really has no real role for large vessel occlusion. Now we're getting into situations where we most recently asked for patients who don't have a what we call a large vessel occlusion, but a medium vessel occlusion, occlusion out, say, in the M3 branch of the middle cerebral artery. Those are much smaller vessels. It requires a much smaller catheter to get to them. It's more complicated anatomically to get to them. And those patients tend to have lower severity in terms of their stroke because it's a very specific area of the brain that's being targeted. So that's where the current controversy is. And most recently at the International Stroke Conference earlier this year, there were some clinical trials presented that seemed to show that that may be where we're reaching the limit of utility for the procedure, albeit there's still a lot of open questions about those patients. So we're finally getting to that point where we're finding patients who may not benefit in certain respects.
What would you say, I mean, just to kind of lay it out for everybody, at least for you, which vessels and what time frame is your considered you know, potentially eligible for a thrombectomy.
Right. I would say any large vessels. So we're talking about internal carotid artery. And that includes what we would call a tandem occlusion. So if you have a patient who comes in with an occlusion in their cervical carotid artery, who also has a blockage up in the internal, you know, say in the internal carotid artery or M1 segment, where basically they had a cervical stenosis that ruptured, closed off the artery, and sent a piece of the clot up into the brain. That's a tandem occlusion. So that is something we do a lot of now. M1, A1, vertebrobasilar, particularly the basilar artery. Those are all considered large vessel occlusions. And so those are the ones that we're the most aggressive with. In terms of time frame, I would, if you're in a position where you see such a patient who is within 24 hours of their last known normal, you definitely want to reach out and to a neurointerventionalist to see if they're a candidate.
Is a lot of this, is there a lot of heterogeneity in practice? I mean, the things you just described, was that going to apply most places for most interventionalists? Or is there a lot of different local protocols or even person to person? Like a particular individual may believe in intervening on a certain thing or have the skill set to do it, but the next person may not.
I think thrombectomy, I mean, in general, thrombectomy is, for those of us who are in neurointerventional space who do procedures, thrombectomy is one of the less complicated things we do from a technical standpoint. And so most neurointerventionalists should be absolutely comfortable doing a standard thrombectomy. I mean, it still requires a lot of skill. I would not encourage people who are not neurointerventionally trained to start doing it on a whim. It's something that is part of our training. It's part of our lexicon. But in general, I think you'll see most neurointerventionalists are pretty aggressive. What I will say, you know, jumping off of from your question a little bit, what I would say is that you will see variances from one place to another with regard to how those patients get into the system and how they're triaged and how the workflow is optimized to get them into the lab. So I'll use our shop as an example. So we use a basically an app called Viz. Viz AI. There are others, you know, I'm not here to plug one or the other over. That's just the one we use. There are others, for example, like Rapid or ADOC. These are essentially remote imaging and communication apps. And so if someone in one of our outlying collaborating hospitals gets a CT angiogram for stroke, those images are instantaneously, without us having to ask, sent to our phones. We can review the images, and we also have a HIPAA-protected text messaging portion of the app that allows us to communicate with the outside provider. So even while I've been sitting here, I've gotten 3 Viz alerts. Now, I'm not on call right now. One of my partners are covering. So, but my point is they come in, you know, in multitudes throughout the day. And we look at the CT angiogram, and if we see a large vessel occlusion, we can activate a transfer that for that patient without ever having to pick up a phone. You know, in our case, the UK bed coordinators are monitoring the Viz chat, and when they see one of us providers say transfer for thrombectomy, they jump into action and accept the transfer. So there's no like picking up the phone and waiting 15 minutes for a provider to accept the transfer. Not every system has that. Other systems use other, you know, other healthcare systems might use other modalities. The point being, though, you want to be in a system that really tries to optimize that timing and, you know, to try to shave off every minute we can to get that patient from where they are onto our angio table.
And so you guys are not even doing perfusion scans anymore?
I still use CT perfusion in very select cases, primarily in medium vessel occlusions. Or in cases where sometimes we'll have a complicated situation where we believe a patient has a chronic occlusion and we're trying to figure that, decipher that. So some patients will come in and their story, their clinical presentation, it's more consistent with a chronic occlusion or some other kind of process. Examples are Moya, where it's kind of like a mimic of a large vessel occlusion, and you're trying to decipher, hey, is this one of those odd mimics? Because I don't want to be taking a patient to the angio suite if it's not a real, true, acute large vessel occlusion.
Okay. But in the absence of those situations, in less than 24 hours or so, large vessel occlusion on a CTA, you're considering them. Now, are there factors that would rule them out?
Not really. We're pretty liberal. We've done cases where the patient was having a simultaneous heart attack and a stroke. And, you know, we've worked with our cath folks where, you know, the cardiac guys come and they do their part and we do our part and so, et cetera. We've had all sorts of situations, patients with cancer, patients with all sorts of other comorbidities. The issue at hand is that, you know, unless the patient is DNR, DNI, and, you know, on comfort care or hospice or something like that, if they are a functional person, you know, there's a lot of questions still about patients who, you know, are, say, who have advanced dementia, obviously, or are severely disabled at baseline. Those are cases where you get into the little bit of an ethical gray zone of whether there's true, you're really benefiting the patient or not. So that is an area of debate that still exists. But for your average patient who is otherwise a functional, you know, at baseline, we usually, you know, we almost always, you know, treat them.
So let's talk real quick about the role then for systemic thrombolytics in these cases. If we're going more and more to just taking them no matter what to the angio suite to do the thrombectomy. I hate to keep comparing it to cardiology, but I know that a lot of our listeners are going to be more familiar with cardiology than neurology. You know, if a patient rolls into the ED in a center that can do PCI, we don't give them TPA. We just take them to the cath lab. Is there still a role for systemic thrombolytics in these stroke patients?
Absolutely. And that question has started to be addressed in the sense that we're starting, there are some trials that have gone on, are going on to try to ask those questions as to whether or not it's really worth it to use systemic thrombolytics in patients who you're definitely taking to angio for thrombectomy. As it stands right now, today, you know, April 22nd, 2025, we generally recommend that those patients continue onward to get the standard of care of intravenous thrombolytics if able to do so, and especially if it's not going to slow down their ability to get to the angio suite. And that's especially the case now as many places have switched to TNK. So for those in the audience who don't know, traditionally, the original IV thrombolytic was intravenous TPA. You know, when intravenous TPA came on the scene, it was a bolus with a 1 hour infusion. And now you have TNK or tenecteplase, which is simply an IV push medication. So it can be given very rapidly. It can be given at the outside hospital and then the patient can be transported and it can be working while the patient is getting to us. So in most large vessel occlusion cases, TNK may not open up the vessel. However, have I seen that happen? Absolutely. Absolutely. And so generally speaking, our philosophical approach is we want the patient to get a treatment as soon as they possibly can, right? So if the patient's, you know, a 30-minute chopper ride from our hospital and the ED doc has TNK in hand and there's no contraindications, definitely give the drug and then put the patient on the chopper and go. And I can think of at least 5 cases in the last 4 years where the patient cleared their large vessel occlusion with the TNK and didn't need thrombectomy. So it does happen. And the sooner we can get that blood vessel open, the better. So as it stands right now, you know, in 2025, today, I would definitely recommend giving IV thrombolytics, even if the patient's going to thrombectomy. They are also not a contraindication to thrombectomy in any way. Years ago, we did these kind of like half treatment, you know, drip and ship kind of protocols where patients would get kind of like the half bolus or whatever, because there was this fear of complication. And our, you know, we've since kind of gone away from that where we just give the full dose because we have the ability to control you know, issues much better in the angio suite. In addition, our complication rates from thrombectomy have dropped really low now. And our access site complications have also gotten better as we, many of us have switched from femoral access as our primary access modality to upper extremity. So instead of accessing the femoral artery, I do almost all my strokes through the wrist.
So, and I would assume that, you know, you're saying, you know, give the TNK because it's going to take a little bit to get them to the center or whatever. But I would assume that that applies too, even if they walked in the door of the UK ER, right? Because
absolutely,
it's still going to take a few minutes, even if it's, you know, 1 in the afternoon on a Monday to get somebody up to the angio suite.
Yes. And the other reason for that is, you know, okay, patient's got an M1 occlusion. I go up there, I engage the thrombus and I start sucking it out through our reperfusion catheter, kind of like vacuuming out. You know, it's like a little vacuum that sucks up the clot. But if a little tiny piece breaks off and goes way out into an M2, M3, M4 branch, I don't have a catheter that small to chase it, but the drug can get to that. And that's where TNK does a great job, with these little tiny distal clots. So having both on board is definitely, in a case like that, can be fruitful.
So you mentioned, I want to talk real quick, you mentioned radial access versus femoral access. For folks out there who are, let's say they're ED providers, or even just like me, they're an ICU provider who may see the patient in the ED before they go up to the angio suite, and they're kind of trying to get a jump on getting some stuff done while we're waiting. You know, I know we try to avoid the right radial artery for arterial line placement. Is that sort of standard?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say, you know, if you can, avoid the right upper extremity. What we tend to do is we ultrasound the upper extremity while prepping the patient. And we either go transradial or transulnar, depending upon which the bigger vessel is. So we're very comfortable accessing either one of them. And so, you know, it's extremely helpful if we don't have anything around the right wrist. Can I do left radial? Definitely. And we've done that too. But it takes a few extra steps and it's a little bit more onerous. So if given the choice, I would definitely, you know, ask that the right wrist, entire wrist, be clean of anything, if possible. We've worked around IVs and such. It's not a big deal, but, you know, if you're asking.
Yeah.
It certainly seems like radial access has not penetrated yet as much as it has in the maybe cardiology world. No. I've only ever seen femoral access for neuro interventions.
That's right. It took off a few years ago, kind of right before COVID hit. We started gaining some interest in it. And I think part of the issue was that a lot of our access devices were not designed for radial. And now that's changing. Many of the device companies are building access catheters that are, you know, really designed to go through the upper extremity. It does take there's a big learning curve there. So if there are any neurointerventionalists in the audience who haven't really engaged in upper extremity access, I would say start with diagnostic angiograms and go from there, because it is a big learning curve in terms of how to navigate the anatomy, how to get your catheters up. There's definitely some, you know, some major differences with technique in regard to, you know, getting your devices into the intracranial space.
Okay. So, all right. So let's get back to our patients. Our lady gets there. You know, you've already seen the images. You've got the team standing by. She goes straight from the helipad to the angio suite. In this case, let's say you find a left tandem occlusion that you mentioned. Kind of what's your process as far as, not to get too deep in the weeds, right? Because none of us are going to be performing the procedure, but just so we have an idea, like what's going on, you know. I think we sometimes feel like these interventions in the OR is the same thing. It's sort of this black box, you know, patient goes in sick, comes out better. Can you kind of walk us through a little bit like what happens?
Yeah. You mean for a tandem?
Yeah. For example.
All right. So tandem occlusion. And again, just to define that for the audience, what we're talking about is typically the pathology is at the carotid artery in the cervical region at the carotid bifurcation, where the patient's probably had a stenosis there for some time. The plaque ruptures closes off the artery, but in the process sends a piece of the, you know, the plaque or the thrombus up into the brain, say to the M1 segment of the MCA. So we will use, you know, we'll access, in some cases like this, we might vary things up a little bit, use a slightly different access catheter that may have a balloon on it so we can stop blood flow if we need to. We do, I penetrate the cervical, you know, thrombus, and the key is to find your way through the thrombus with a wire and not dissect the vessel in the process. And there's some techniques that we do to do that. And oftentimes I'll go up with a little balloon and I'll essentially balloon open that cervical occlusion, similar to doing a balloon angioplasty as part of a carotid, you know, stenting procedure. And so I balloon it open enough to get past it. We drive our catheters through that carotid plaque up into the upper carotid artery, do the thrombectomy. So I've essentially taken the carotid plaque out of the process because we went by it. Okay, so now we do our thrombectomy, getting the vessel open inside the head. That's all nice and good. And now we're about to come out, and on our way out, we kind of convert the procedure to a typical carotid stent, where we put up a distal protection device. I pull back my distal access my access catheter, and now I'm set up to do a standard carotid stenting procedure where we angioplasty it, put the stent in. The only difference there is if the patient is known to be on aspirin and Plavix, we're good, right? They've got their dual antiplatelets on board. If they don't have that as a background, we can actually give them an intra-arterial antiplatelet agent like Integrilin in order to kind of jumpstart that process so they don't just clot the stent right off and then start the aspirin and Plavix, you know, that evening and the next day. So that's kind of how our process works there.
And we talk about stenting, that's just a carotid thing. If you just go and pull something out of like an MCA, all you're doing is aspirating the thrombus.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. In about 70% of the cases, you're absolutely correct. Most cases of large vessel occlusions are thromboembolic, meaning the embolus or thrombus in the brain came from elsewhere. Typically, obviously, the most common source is the heart. So that's a very common source. Patients with atrial fibrillation, they spew a thrombus up into their brain. We go and we suck it out and we're done. Hey, you know, the procedure took 10 minutes, high fives all around, and we're good. There are some cases, though, where patients have intracranial stenosis. They've had an M1 that's had a stenosis from intracranial atherosclerosis, and then that plaque ruptured and clotted off. And so how that looks is we usually go up, we do the thrombectomy, the vessel gets open, but we can see on that first run after we've opened it that it's narrowed. And then we employ a nice little technique that I call we watch, which is anytime I put anything in the brain, I usually watch the patient for 10 minutes on the table taking pictures just to see what's going to happen to that device or that, you know, what we did. Because that it's much better to catch a problem in the moment than to, you know, high five, close up, and then catch it when they're already in the recovery room when they don't have the result that you wanted. So we watch that vessel for a few minutes. And if it's truly a ruptured plaque, it'll usually start shutting back down again because it's a very unstable situation. And that's when you know, hey, that's the actual problem. You know, there's an intracranial stenosis there. The plaque ruptured. Yes, I reopened it temporarily, but that ruptured plaque is extremely thrombogenic right now. So then that's the case where we would, again, emergently angioplasty it and most likely stent it intracranially. So you're correct in the sense that most of the time it's just a plumbing job. Go up, suck the clot out, and get out. But we always have to keep that possibility in the back of our minds.
What's the sort of standard time frame, right? Let's say somebody's up in the ICU, and let's say I'm new, and I get a call that there's a patient in thrombectomy that's going to be coming up to the ICU. Is that something like I need to start getting ready right now? Is it going to be an hour from now? At what point should I get concerned that they haven't come up yet?
For most of our patients, the procedure takes, you know, once we get access, the procedure takes anywhere from 20 minutes to 40 minutes, you know, for a standard thrombectomy. When you start introducing other things like we mentioned, tandem occlusion, intracranial athro, that usually tacks on an extra 30 to 40 minutes, you know, when all is said and done. Now, different institutions have different standards when it comes to how these patients look. There are some institutions that do all their thrombectomies with the patient awake and non-intubated, with maybe not even anesthesia that present. Our institution, because of the many of our patients have significant comorbidities, often have comorbid heart conditions, oftentimes cannot lie still. Many of them have COPD and can't lie flat comfortably without being very uncomfortable. So we made the decision years ago to, we just do all of our thrombectomies under general anesthesia, and we leave the patients intubated and we send them to the ICU intubated without rushing the extubation. Many patients with acute stroke can have issues with swallowing and protecting their airway. And so we kind of opted for this, what we can determine to be the safest option. Now, there have been studies done trying to compare outcomes related to patients who have their thrombectomy done awake versus under anesthesia. Generally speaking, I think most practitioners would agree that whatever you choose, however you choose to do this, just do it efficiently, right? So what you don't want to do is do half and half, but the 50% of people are getting anesthesia. It takes forever to get the anesthesia team. They're not always ready. That adds another 40 minutes to the case because they won't let you work on the patient while they're intubating. You don't want a situation like that. There you're not adding a lot and you're taking away. In our case, you know, we've been very fortunate to have some fantastic anesthesia providers who have been very collaborative on this. And so when we activate a thrombectomy, they show up to the NG suite. We don't call them. They come. And they also understand that we're not going to be hands-off while they're doing their work. We're prepping the patient. While they're intubating, we're positioning the wrist and starting to prep the wrist and draping them. And they understand that they're going to have to work around us, with us, in a collaborative effort. And so we've created that cultural expectation in our institution. But you will see some variance from, you know, one place to another in terms of what, you know, what each provider likes and what the resources they have are.
Okay. Well, so we'll assume that, all goes well in the angio suite and you're able to, you know, get the clot out and stent the ICA as part of that tandem occlusion. And then the patient's coming up to the ICU. What do we need to know in terms of post-procedural care for these people?
Right. There is some variation on how people feel about blood pressure control. We try to keep, if we've reperfused the patient successfully, we try to keep the, you know, our systolic less than 160 for 24 hours before relaxing them, simply in an effort to avoid reperfusion hemorrhage. I will freely admit that that is somewhat controversial in terms of there's a lack of relative, you know, guidelines on exactly how that should play out. There have been some, you know, back and forth trials on what to do around that. As far as extubation, I think we wake the patient up and doing it when you feel it's safe. It's very common for us to want postoperative imaging. Typically an MRI is performed within, you know, 12 to 24 hours. That's important primarily to look for, see the size of the infarct, right? And so if you've got a 60-year-old who had a right M1 occlusion that you did a thrombectomy on, but that you do the MRI and now they have a very large stroke, just simply, yeah, you did a good job, but, you know, sometimes patients come in too late, you know, they've already have a lot of injury and swelling. So now you get into issues of, you know, do they need a decompressive craniectomy? So that's one of the main reasons to get the MRI. And this is especially important in the posterior circulation as well. You know, if you open up a Basler and the patient's doing great because their brainstem did fine and didn't get infarcted, all is well, except if they had a significant cerebellar stroke in the process, that can be life-threatening from the point of edema and compression of the brainstem. So it is important to follow up on that. if we get, you know, oftentimes the MRI doesn't happen for the first 8 to 12 hours. So we'll usually get a non-contrast head CT or a dual energy CT, as we often use it, basically to see if there's any hemorrhagic conversion in the first few hours. Cause that again is a complication you really want to stay ahead of if it starts happening.
Real quick, for folks who aren't a bit, aren't familiar with the terminology dual energy CT, can you kind of explain what you mean by that?
You know, and I'll say that I'm not a, from a perspective of the physics of the radiology scans, I would have to leave that to someone else. But basically, from a clinical management standpoint, what the dual energy does is it helps us delineate hemorrhage from contrast staining. So patients who've had an infarct, sometimes, you know, we're doing these angios, we're injecting contrast over and over again. Sometimes the contrast will kind of stain the injured brain, and that can be mistaken for hemorrhage. So the dual energy helps us to delineate hemorrhage from other, you know, other things like that.
Okay. So our lady is up in the ICU. We're doing the blood pressure control. We're doing our follow-up scans. What's family comes in and wants to know kind of, what do you think? What's the prognosis for this lady? What is the typical prognosis for a patient after a thrombectomy?
Well, it depends on exactly how much ischemic damage occurred and where that damage is. So a patient who had a cerebellar infarct, for example, those are extremely recoverable. The cerebellum is a very redundant part of the brain, and patients can, with good rehab, do very, very well. A person who had infarcted their entire brainstem has a very different prognosis. Those patients tend not to do well. You know, there's a big difference between a right MCA stroke and a left MCA stroke in terms of what's going on there. You know, left MCA, for most people, that's their dominant hemisphere. So their dominant side or the right side, as well as their speech, is going to be affected. I will tell you that it can be very unpredictable who's going to do well and who doesn't. I remember, just to give some anecdotal examples, I remember getting called one night and seeing on the viz a woman who was 92 years old with a left MCA occlusion. And, you know, I was talking to the stroke neurology resident who was in the ER seeing her. And he said, this is a 92-year-old female coming in from her nursing home. And already I'm thinking to myself, oh, she's already disabled, coming from a nursing home. And I said, is this really a good candidate? He's like, no, you don't understand. She works in the nursing home. And I was like, oh, okay. And so we took her for thrombectomy. She was discharged 2 days later. And 2 weeks later, she was back working in the nursing home. Like, you know, you just never know sometimes. We tend to err on the side of treating these folks because we don't always have all the information when we have to make these decisions. So, you know, our tendency is to err on the side of life, so to speak. You know, many, we've had situations where patients, especially in our state, and I'm sure other, you know, others in the audience probably have had a similar situation where patients are coming from hundreds of miles away. The family either couldn't be reached or no one's been able to get in touch with them. So you don't really know, like, you know, a lot about the situation. So we kind of err on the side of doing the thrombectomy, understanding that, you know, I've had situations where I did a thrombectomy and the patient comes in, or the patient's family comes 2 days later, and you find out all this extra information that you just didn't have access to in the moment, right? But because of the severe time-based nature of this acute emergent problem, we have to make decisions in the moment sometimes.
Yeah. Well, we've talked before on the podcast about the difficulty with prognostication, and especially one of the things that as ICU providers, we tend to run into is this pessimism about things, because we only see people at their worst. And yes. Whether it's with patients like this or patient transplant patients or cardiac surgery patients or whatever, we tend to see them at their worst. And we forget that those of you who do primary care, not primary care, you know, for these people who see them follow up in clinic and stuff, maybe have a better perspective on these things. And I think it's real easy for us to go, oh my gosh, I can't believe we're going to do this. Right. But I think you make a good point in a procedure that has very little downside to it. In the moment, it does seem pretty reasonable to err on the side of let's just do everything. If we find out later that, like you said, this patient has 18 comorbidities and is going to be a very poor outcome no matter what, well, fine. But we haven't really done them any harm. But if it turns out that she's the 92-year-old who's working at the nursing home, we've potentially missed a chance to save her life and function.
No, absolutely. And to your point, one of the issues that we do face with this situation is we don't always have all the information when we're forced to make that decision. It is a life-saving procedure in many respects. And so we tend to err on the side of life. And then, you know, if we don't have an opportunity to have those conversations. And I think, you know, in talking to my partners or my colleagues rather, in other parts of the country who live in very high urban areas, they often have more information because the patients aren't coming from so far away. They're easier to reach. People know what's going on. Many of our patients here in Kentucky are coming from what would be a 2 or 3 hour drive, and they're being flown in. Their family is, you know, just getting contacted, and they're trying their best to race to the hospital, but it's going to be hours before we can even get in touch with them. So we're forced to make these decisions with sometimes not all the information.
Brandon, what else do we have to talk about, you think?
You know, talking about complications, I guess, one of the arguments you usually hear for doing the perfusion scans that sounds like moved away from is that very large infarct beds are at higher risk after you reperfuse them of either hemorrhagic conversion or a lot of cerebral edema. Do you find that's not the case? Or is it just that it sounds like the more recent data suggests that you may or may not have complications, but the net is still supports attempting the intervention regardless of what a scan might have showed you?
Right. I think it's mostly the latter of what you just said. We do recognize that larger infarcts do come with reperfusing larger infarcts does come with a slightly elevated risk of hemorrhage, albeit even patients, but then you balance that against patients who didn't get reperfused with those larger infarcts and they still have a risk of hemorrhage. And so they're generally, the larger the infarct, you know, can have, are at higher risk of more infarct-related complications, edema, as you said, compression of the brain, hemorrhagic conversion. But on balance, reperfusing those patients still gives them a better outcome overall.
Where is the state of the science with this technique? Is there a lot that is still advancing? Does it start to feel like technologically we're at a good spot? Now it's just kind of down to workflow things? Or what's kind of next on the horizon? What's the new hotness?
Right. I would say that the companies that make the devices that we use, we've benefited from classic competition where you've got essentially about four major large device companies that make these neuroendovascular devices. And then you've got a smattering of smaller companies that essentially are developing the next best thing and with the hopes of frankly selling it to one of the bigger ones, right? Mm. And so over the last 10 years, it's been virtually every year we're seeing some new tool to take care of thrombectomy. And to your point, at some point you kind of have to say, okay, you know, I'm getting reperfusion 96% of the time. And you're telling me this new tool is going to get me to 97%. Is it really that much better? Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure, you know, I'm not here to plug a particular device or anything like that. It's so innovative though, that at our institution, every 2 years, 2 to 3 years, we actually retrial all the company devices to see what we think is working best so that we're not wedded to particular companies over and over again. So I think arterial thrombectomy for large vessel occlusion stroke, we are getting to a point of, you know, where we can say, hey, we're doing a really good job here from a technical standpoint. There's still a lot of more to be done around the procedure, you know, getting patients triaged appropriately, getting them to centers, you know, figuring out, you know, where can we bring the provider to the patient virtually through things like robotics and things like that. There's a lot of interest in those questions, but the actual performing of the procedure, I think, is getting to a point where we're almost saturated in terms of how well we're doing. I mean, much of the newer things that we're doing in the interventional suite are not related to arterial large vessel occlusion stroke. There's a whole host of new tools and new diseases that we're treating that we were not treating even just 10 years ago.
And just to familiarize people who are not intimately familiar with this super specialized area, if I get on the phone with a neurointerventionalist to talk about a thrombectomy, is it correct that many times this is a neurosurgeon who did a fellowship in endovascular therapy? It could be an interventional radiologist. And it, I think in rare cases, it could be a neurologist. Is that?
Actually, yes. The answer is yes, but you've got the ratios wrong.
Okay.
So when neurointerventional first kind of took off, you know, in the late 20th century, it was primarily a field of radiologists. They were the ones that started it, both in America and in Europe and France. Primarily radiologists who are making, I mean, they used to make the catheters in their garages, you know, I mean, these, this was crazy stuff, you know, and so it was primarily the realm of radiologists who eventually be, you know, from a training perspective were patient for folks who went through radiology residency, neuroradiology fellowship, and then neurointerventional fellowship. And then in the kind of late 90s, early 2000s, I think neurosurgeons who were open cerebrovascular neurosurgeons started to say, hey, this is really cool stuff. I want to be able to do that too. And they started getting training in it and doing the fellowships. And so it initially
did that
was
start with like aneurysm care? Was that?
Yeah. The interest in taking care of aneurysms and things like that. And so that grew. And then just in the last probably 15 and 20 years, I think we've started to see a lot more neurologists, especially as stroke became a much bigger area of interest, who had done a neurology residency and a stroke neurology residency or fellowship and now wanted to do neurointervention. And actually that, if you look at who's trying to get into neurointerventional fellowships today, a large portion of those trainees are neurologists. So what I would say is I have the view that I think it's great that we have a number of different folks from different backgrounds coming to this fellowship. I've got my faculty at UK is not all of one specialty. And as I was recruiting partners, I made sure of that because I really value that multidisciplinary view and having folks coming from different backgrounds. Some of our major societies, so for example, one of our major professional societies is the Society for Neurointerventional Surgery, absolutely embraces that idea. And if you look at their leadership structure, you know, and who's on their board, it's an absolute mix of folks from different specialties. And I think it really brings something special to the field because it's a more collaborative environment. And people come to it with different viewpoints. And so we don't always agree on everything, but that's okay. And I think that actually gives us strength. You know, and I really enjoy one of my most favorite neurointerventionalists that I worked with on a national level is a radiologist. And, you know, we have little debates all the time, but it's in great fun and out of tremendous respect for each other.
Well, it certainly seems like, you know, while I'm sure you could put these different people with different backgrounds in a room and they could have some arm wrestling contests and argue about who has more dexterous thumbs or whatever. I mean, if you were the patient and you turned up at some smaller hospital, at the end of the day, the biggest limitation, at least where we're at now, is probably going to be, is there someone who can do it? And a lot of places, the answer is no. And, you know, they could be transferred and so on. But probably the most benefit is just extending this opportunity to more and more people in more and more places. So you just need people who can do the thing.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how much time we have left because you just opened a big can of worms, which involves about a couple hours of debate. But let me try to sum it up. Yet on the surface, you would say, let's just put a neurointerventionalist in every community hospital in America, and then they can do thrombectomies. The trouble with that, though, is if you look at the volume from a say, a community in Kentucky, right? Pick your poison, Danville, Ashland. These are all towns, smaller towns in Kentucky, right? And they have great, great hospitals that do great community care. But how many strokes are they going to be dealing with on a daily basis? It's relatively low. And then what is that neurointerventionist going to do when they're not doing stroke, right? Mm-hmm. How are they going to keep their skill set up, right? How is the angio suite, the techs and the nurses in the angio suite, if all they ever do is emergencies, are they going to be good at it, right? So you have to balance I understand the idea of access, but it's been shown time and time again that patients do best with any kind of procedure when they're in the hands of a provider and ancillary providers who do it at a certain volume, right? So you have to kind of balance those things out. I do embrace the idea of growing the access to thrombectomy, but I think it should be done in a very particular way, right? You want to make sure before you pull the trigger on offering thrombectomy in a particular community hospital, I would say that there should be certain things in place. You want to make sure you have providers there that can do it. As important is for that community hospital to have a clear link to a larger comprehensive stroke center that can provide the backup, right? So when that neurointerventionist is out of town, or if they get a complex case that is, you know, that needs more than just what the community hospital can offer, and having a relationship between those two institutions that's open and collaborative rather than competitive. I think that's a really key if you're trying to grow access out in the community. Unfortunately, that's, you know, oftentimes the growth of thrombectomy is not dictated by such principles, but rather by, you know, hospitals wanting the procedure done there for many reasons, including fiscal. And I think that's a problem.
So even if interventionalists were growing on trees, putting a thrombectomy clinic in every strip mall in America is not necessarily the best.
Right. Yeah. So you could say we're going to do thrombectomy, you know, at the hospital an hour away, but then that means one of me and my providers have to drive there to do it. Right. And versus bringing the patient to us, which is the same distance. So these are open philosophical questions. I don't have all the answers, wouldn't pretend to. What I do think is that it's important for us to continually have these discussions and to really come up with new ways to increase access. Access is pretty easy in the cities. You know, if you look at a place like, say, New York, not to criticize New York, I train there, great hospitals there. But I mean, they've got a thrombectomy shop like every 20 blocks in New York City. And, you know, there's no issue with access there. Although you could argue that problems with traffic limit the access. but there's definitely a problem with access where I work in Kentucky, where, you know, a significant portion of our patients are coming from 2 and 3 hours away. And what happens when the weather's bad and we can't fly? And one of the other issues we face is, you know, let's say we identify a patient in one of our rural Appalachian counties that might have one EMS house that has 2 buses, right? And now we're going to ask them to take one of their ambulances out of service, essentially to transport a patient 2 hours each way. So now that entire county is left with one ambulance for 4 to 6 hours. Mm-hmm. So these are very important questions that I don't really have a whole lot of answers to right now, in the sense of how do we make that happen? And there are ideas being floated around. There's a lot of interest in growing access and, you know, talking about ways to improve transportation for these patients in the rural communities, but it's certainly something that requires more attention.
All right. Well, I'm sure we could keep that conversation going, like you said, for a lot longer, but in the interest of time, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thanks for coming on. I think this has been super helpful. Even for those of us who do neuro on a regular basis, it's good to see sort of behind the curtain into the black box of the angio suite. we want to remind folks that everything here is just our personal opinion. We don't represent our various institutions officially. And this is all general educational content and should not be construed as medical advice. Thanks, everybody, and we'll see you next time.